Here we go. Whenever you guys are ready.
Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples. Physicist Dave Rogstad is off today. On today's podcast, why does philosophy matter? Get comfortable as Ken digs into that question today. Ken, people who know you know that you like to talk about philosophy. You are an instructor, and you can't help but let it ooze out, and a lot of people appreciate you for that. So what are we in store for today?
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the way I see the value of philosophy. So Joe, early in this show, we'll just kind of remind people about what philosophy is and why it's important, how it's influenced me. But I'd also like to reference a study that just came out. This is called Academic Influence, and they take all kinds of information off of the web in various places, and they give you the top 100 philosophers today. So they're looking at the kind of influence that people have. And I'd like to talk about some of those philosophers. Interestingly, a couple very distinguished philosophers made it into the top 10. And I think it'll give us a lot of discussion in terms of who are these philosophers and why are they important?
Terrific. All right. Well, I am ready to go.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about philosophy. And, you know, when I was a young kid, I remember very distinctly that I felt kind of a restlessness in life, and I knew, even as a teenager, that I was searching. I was looking for something in life. I remember I liked all of the popular music songs that kind of left you with that sense of searching and looking. And the Catholicism that I had experienced as a young boy didn't take a deep hold on me. That's probably more my own fault than a lack of substance there. But I would define philosophy as a quest. I think that's a good way of thinking about it. The first philosophy class I had at Cerritos College, which was a junior college here in Southern California, suburb of Los Angeles. I remember my first professor, Doug Wessel, who I still think is probably the best teacher I ever had. He talked about philosophy as an activity, a quest or a journey to discover wisdom. And I was attracted by that. We can define philosophy as the pursuit of wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. For a specific purpose. Why are you looking for wisdom, knowledge, and understanding? So that you can live the good life. And the good life by the classical philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, they would say that's a moral education. Have you lived a good life? And that gripped me. Philosophy involves things like reflection, contemplation, and I think a spirit of curiosity. You know, you're asking the big questions. Why is the world here? Is there a God? How do I live my life ethically? What happens to me when I die? Those are kind of the big questions. And I remember as a young man, and I know you and I lived in a pretty much near the same places. I used to go down to the beach as a teenager. Seal Beach was our kind of favorite hangout. And we'd go down to the pier late at night. And I remember looking out at the ocean and thinking, wow, where did the ocean come from? And what is the meaning of all of these things? And I have a sense, Joe, that there was a longing. I sensed that when I looked at the ocean, there was a longing about who am I? Why am I here? And you know, what does nature have to say to me? And of course, I'm thinking there in terms of this argument from desire that C.S. Lewis develops, that that we look out at the world and we have deeper longings. Those weren't always easy issues to kind of keep to myself. I'm not sure all of my friends who I would go to parties with were all that interested. They were more interested in talking about Led Zeppelin or, you know, how attractive some of the young girls were. But those were things that kind of stood behind me. Now, I think I would also want to say, Joe, that I think that philosophy involves what I would call a deep sense of thinking critically. You know, I think that philosophy really is a questioning. And, I saw it that way. If you're going to discover wisdom, and the word philosophy literally means, philia is one of the Greek words for love. Sophia is a Greek word for wisdom. So philosophy is the love of wisdom. Now, one of the things we've talked about before, Joe, is for a long time, in fact, for 2,500 years, people have complained about philosophy. And one of the major complaints is, what does it do? Right? I remember telling my dad I want to take a degree in philosophy, and he was baffled. And he asked me, well, how much money does it pay? Which is a good question, by the way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the ancient world, Joe, people would say philosophy bakes no bread. It doesn't make a practical difference. And I think that one of the things that attracts me to philosophy is that ideas really matter, and big ideas matter most. Now, you know, in this show and in the next show, I'm going to introduce our listeners to some of the top philosophers in the world. And, you know, you may never have heard many of their names, but you know the influence that they have spread. And what's interesting in terms of Christianity, now looking at philosophy from a Christian standpoint, in Christian history, philosophy was seen as a handmaid to theology. Philosophy wasn't seen as the be-all and end-all. Rather, philosophy and all of this critical analysis was seen as a way of serving theology. And, you know, when we think about apologetics, I mean, Reasons to Believe is a science faith organization. You get a lot of science, and we look at how science and faith work together. Well, you have other apologetic organizations that emphasize philosophical apologetics, or you have literary apologetics. Apologetics goes in various directions, but I think it's important to be able to note that philosophy is a very significant field. But in terms of theology, it's to serve theology, not the other way around, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Now, a couple other areas, just to kind of give this this overview of philosophy. Here's a couple quotations from the people that I think forged philosophy. Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. The unexamined life is not worth living. I believe that. I remember first time I read that quote from Socrates, the unexamined life. I want to live a good life. At the end of my life, I want to be able to look back and say, I have lived a meaningful and purposeful and deep life. Of course, from a Christian context, I look forward to hopefully the Lord saying to me, well done, good and faithful servant. But I don't want to live a unexamined life, a superficial life. Here's a quote from Plato. He says, life without philosophy is inconceivable. I think what he means is there are too many big questions in life not to delve into philosophy. And then Aristotle said that all men by nature desire to know. I think that he might have an argument in the time in which we live. I'm not sure how many people really want to know, but I think that's the nature of human beings. I think we ask questions. We want to know what is life about, and how do I live it? If I could kind of summarize what I would call the branches or fields of philosophy, and our listeners will know these fields. I would identify six areas, Joe, that philosophy opens up. The first one is called metaphysics. Metaphysics is the study of the ultimate nature, structure, and characteristics of reality. And so if you ask the question, what is real, you're engaging in metaphysics. Could be you're talking about God. It could be you're talking about, is there anything beyond the universe, or is the universe all there is? So questions about the nature, structure, and of reality is metaphysics. The second area, very, very important, it's called epistemology, the study of the origin, nature, and limits and validity of knowledge. What is the difference between knowledge and opinion? What does it mean to know something? Philosophers have typically said to know something, you have to have justified true belief. That is, you have to believe something. You have to have reasons to believe that it is true. And so it has to be justified true belief. Well, epistemology is very important. How do I know God? How do I know that I have a rational perspective? A third category of philosophy is ethics, the study of moral goodness, what is good. So metaphysics, what is real, epistemology, what is true, ethics, what is good. Then aesthetics, the study of beauty, taste, and art, what's beautiful. Logic, the study of the principles of sound reasoning, what is reasonable. And then lastly, value theory, the study of the value of things in general, other than moral value. So what is valuable? Joe, I think what you can see here is in these six branches, they relate to really fundamental questions. Metaphysics, what is real? Epistemology, what is true? Ethics, what is good? Aesthetics, what is beautiful? Logic, what is reasonable? Value theory, what is valuable? And these can be applied to many areas. Now, one of the points that I like to make with people is I think philosophy is underestimated. I think it's underestimated largely because I think we live in a time that's very practical. You might find a degree in another field that you think is much more practical, like being a plumber. You know, that does, when your toilet's backed up, when your pipes are not working, that's a practical thing to have. Or as my father, he was an automobile mechanic. Your car doesn't work, you can't drive to work in the morning. Well, we're a very practical people, I think. Maybe especially Americans tend to be pragmatic. Well, I think what you can realize, however, is when you're talking about what's real, true, or good, those are things that really do come into our life. I mean, ethics, how do I know I'm living the right life? How should I view other people? And so I think what you're going to discover is that many of these names on this list, and I can't talk about all of them, there are 50 of them. I'm going to talk about 10, I think, the top 10, and then maybe bring a couple others into discussion. Joe, I think that philosophy bakes a lot of bread. Today, we live, I think, in a postmodern culture. And I think understanding philosophy will help you understand the world you're living in and how to navigate.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, that very statement, philosophy bakes no bread. How it seems to me that that's a philosophical statement, is it?
It is. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, I just think back to events of, you know, just the last 100 years or so, and what caused some of the major world events, a lot of the tumult that we've seen, world wars and all that. It's philosophy, right? The yeah. Isms. Yeah. I don't know if you want to touch on that at all, but it seems like we can't avoid philosophical ideas.
I think that that's exactly right. I mean, if you look at the 20th century, which was a remarkable century, I remember telling my dad, you know, when we had this little discussion about whether I should study philosophy, I said, Dad, you know, you were part of the Allied armies of World War II that were fighting against fascism, the fascism of Nazi Germany. Those are ideas. Communism, that is an idea about human beings, about power, about wealth. All of these big kind of issues are really, really very important. And I think when you categorize the world into kind of pre-modern, modern, and postmodern, you're really kind of drawing things together and saying, here are the ideas that have deep influence. And so, you know, I think that that was what attracted me. You know, when I studied World War II, I always said I could never get my mind around it. It was so large. There were so many things happening, so many ideas that were part of that cataclysmic struggle. But that's the way I presented it to my father. You know, I said, Dad, ideas have consequences. And I said, you know that, living in the 20th century. And so, you know, I think people get a little impatient with philosophy. I think that sometimes scientists are a little impatient with philosophy. You know, Stephen Hawking has said philosophy is dead. Lawrence Krauss has criticized philosophy and said, you know, science has done away with philosophy. You know, we have experiments to determine what's truth. We don't need philosophy. But of course, to say that experiments give you truth is a philosophical statement. Mm. And to say philosophy is dead is a philosophical statement.
There you go.
and even science itself is based upon presuppositions that are philosophical in nature. You need the right world. You need the right kind of human beings. You need a congruence, right? Science is influenced by both philosophy and theology, but today we've moved away from kind of the beginning stages, and so people don't often associate science with philosophy and theology.
Ken, a question on philosophy as it concerns the scientific method. I think I heard you say something earlier about when you pursue an idea, you have in mind something about how it's going to turn out. I wonder if that applies to the very scientific method. If you're going to set up some kind of experiment, you already have in mind what you're trying to demonstrate. Is that doing philosophy in a way?
I definitely think so. I mean, you know, when scientists kind of develop a hypothesis, you know, I'm gonna try to test. I have this hypothesis. I'm gonna try to falsify it, or I'm gonna try to confirm it. I think that involves a particular type of reasoning and thinking, and scientists, Joe, they use deductive reason, primarily inductive. But I've discovered that scientists, when they develop their hypothesis, it's an abductive. They're looking at an inference to the best explanation. And so I think that science is very rigorous, and it involves many logical and philosophical ideas. Yeah, indeed. Well, let me introduce this the study that was done. Again, this is called Academic Influence. You can go on the web and you can find this. It asks the question, who are the most influential thinkers in the world? And again, it kind of ranks them. It has a criteria of papers that people have written and all of those kinds of things. In fact, let me read very briefly. It says, our technology thus uses artificial intelligence, AI, to aggregate scholarly and academic citations from databases such as Wikipedia, and cross-ref. Evaluate links and other semantic information contained in these databases. Weigh their merits against other information such as periodicals, journals, and global outlets. And it goes on to talk about how they kind of developed this. But I thought it was really interesting. Now, I might also say that this is constantly changing. So if you go on there today, it might be different than the list that I have. People are moving up or moving down because, again, they're calculating or calibrating a lot of these ideas. What's interesting, Joe, is that when I looked at this list, and of course there are a number of various people that are connected to this, but I wanted to make a comment about the selection of individuals. When you look at the list of 50, there are a lot of atheists on the list. I'm going to identify some of them, both in this show and into the next show. But I also want to say that there are some leading Christians that make this list. And in fact, if you look at this list, you might think, wow, Christians are a real minority, or I'm going to use the term theists, are a real minority. Because as I look through the 50 individuals, there were a lot more atheists than there were theists. Now, some of them, I really couldn't discover what they believed. That, what I mean by that is a lot of philosophers are not directly involved in what we would call the philosophy of religion. You know, they may be interested in the philosophy of mathematics. They may be interested in the philosophy of science. They may have areas that don't kind of lead them back directly to God. So there were a few people, I was kind of poking around yesterday on the web trying to figure out, you know, what kind of worldview does this person particularly hold? But I was also reading an article that I want to quote from. It's called 60 Years On, Academic Atheist Philosophers Then and Now. And it's written by Professor Graham Oppie, last name O-P-P-Y, Monash University. Oppie is an Australian philosopher, educated in the States. At least I think he got his doctoral degree from Princeton, if I remember correctly. I would identify Oppie, Joe, as one of the leading atheists today. William Lane Craig, who debates many of the leading atheists and does an outstanding job, in my opinion. William Lane Craig described Oppie as scary smart. That's a lot coming from William Lane Craig, who is a brilliant guy. But let me read you just a section of this, and I want to make a point about atheists and the growth of theists. He says, while the past 60 years has seen a considerable increase in the formal organization of academic theistic philosophers with the formation of new societies, the Evangelical Philosophical Society, I'm part of that, the Society of Christian Philosophers, I'm also part of that one. And he talks about the launch of new journals, Philosophia Christi, I've written articles for them, Faith and Philosophy. There has even been similar developments for academic atheist philosophers. Now, he makes a point here, and I want to read the paragraph and I'll try to help you understand it. It says, the philosophy paper survey may suggest part of the reason for this. It tells us that of the 931 academic philosopher respondents, 73% either accepted or leaned toward atheism, while only 15% accepted or leaned toward theism. Now, he's quoting another study, and he's saying it seems in philosophy that it is heavy in terms of atheism, maybe light in terms of theism. But he also says this, while the exact numbers may be questionable, there is no doubt that atheists are represented in philosophy of religion at a much lower rate than they are represented in philosophy overall. Now, the point being made there is this, that when you think about this academic influence, there are a lot of atheists on there. Good number of theists that are right at the very top, which I think is pretty impressive. But I think you need to understand it in terms of this. Philosophers generally are probably more skeptical. But if you look at the particular field of philosophy called the philosophy of religion, which studies the question of God's existence, which looks at the problem of evil, which looks at various arguments for God, in that particular area of philosophy, you have a lot of theists, you have a lot of Christians. And William Lane Craig has even said that in the last 50 years, you've seen a renaissance in Christian philosophy. So there are many leading thinkers that are theistic and are Christian.
You mentioned Graham Oppy earlier. I watched one debate, that's all I've seen, with he and William Lane Craig, and I found him likable. And I contrast that with, say, a Richard Dawkins, who I don't find likable. And I wonder if that aspect weighs on people. You've talked before about non-rational factors. If I were considering these things, I would be much more inclined to listen to Oppy based on one debate, sure, than I would on Richard Dawkins. I wonder if you might comment on that.
I'm really glad you raised that, Joe, because looking at some of these philosophers just last night, I noticed that some of the leading atheist philosophers, they're not very impressed with the new atheism. And they're not all that impressed for a couple reasons. One, they don't think that they're very rigorous academically. Even though they might agree with their ultimate conclusion, they don't think that Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens, now Dan Dennett does make the list, but there are many atheists, even if they agree, and they would agree that there's no God, they agree with kind of the ultimate metaphysical position advocated by the new atheists, they aren't impressed with their reasoning, or they don't like the way they come off. They don't like the sarcasm, the ridicule. I think that comes out. And, I think there are people who, even if they accept the basic secularism, they don't like a lot of the hostility, dividing people, you know, or, and I want to talk a little bit about this. There are a growing number of atheists, Joe, who see value in Christianity. Even if they don't ultimately think it's true, they think it's been a good force in the world. And it seems to me that the new atheists are different than the old atheists. And we've talked about this a couple times, but old atheists like Nietzsche, Jean-Paul Sartre, J.L. Mackey, A.J. Ayer, these are philosophers in the 20th century. Many of them, even though they rejected theism ultimately, they thought that much of the good things in the world really came from the Judeo-Christian worldview. Mm. Well, speaking of that, Joe, I'd like to talk briefly about two philosophers that make my list. And again, we'll get into that list, and we'll talk about the top 10 and add a few here and there. But Joe, in my latest book, Christianity Cross-Examined, I raised this, I think, a very provocative issue. And that is it possible that we have two types of atheists? Again, this is a paradigm. This is a model, doing a thought experiment. Not every atheist fits neatly into one of these two categories. But you know that model. The model says that maybe there are atheists who would say, you know, it may not be a bad thing if God existed. I might survive the death of my body. I might be reunited with my loved ones. Maybe Christianity has actually been good for the world. But unfortunately, it just can't pass the muster of logic and reason and rationality. So that first atheist is not necessarily opposed, even though he may not, I mean, if God closes in, he may want to push a little further away. In Romans 1, you get kind of inside baseball. The Bible gives you inside baseball about the human condition. And it says the natural disposition, I'm interpreting Paul here, the natural disposition of the fallen human person is to resist God. Why? Because of our moral accountability to him. Now, that first atheist, again, saying, might be good if God existed. You know, the Judeo-Christian message, the justice in Judaism, the love in Christianity, you know, that might be a very good thing, but I just can't get the logic, the reason, the rationality. Now, let me introduce the second atheist again. The second atheist would say, no, there is arguments for God. In fact, there are a lot of them, and there are some pretty good thinkers who have believed that all the way from the ancient world to our present day today. The problem is I don't want that God to exist. I don't want God. I don't want to be accountable to God. I reject that. You know, I've often said that Christopher Hitchens said, if God exists, it's like living in North Korea. Mm. How can I be free? How can I be autonomous if God exists? Well, I think by definition, if God exists and he's all powerful, then you're not autonomous. You are held accountable. So the first atheist, his problem is rationality. The second atheist is he doesn't think God is good, or he doesn't think God would be a good thing, or he doesn't think God has, or Christianity has been a good thing in the world. I want to introduce you to two philosophers that appear in the top 50, and I think they fit that category pretty well. So let me introduce them to you. The first philosopher is Jürgen Habermas. He's a German philosopher associated with the Frankfurt School in Germany. He has done research on social theory, critical philosophy, taught in various places. He's 92 years old, so he's still living. In fact, Habermas grew up in Germany, and he was in the Hitler Youth as Pope Benedict XVI, as virtually every young boy at the time. Mm-hmm. So he's German in his orientation. Again, a lot of contribution in critical theory, neo-pragmatism. What I want to say there is, Joe, if you don't believe in God, then you're going to start asking questions like, what's the framework I do look through the world at? Well, Habermas is going to be looking through the world from a pragmatic standpoint. Pragmatism is a very strong philosophy, you know, and Habermas has interacted with the postmodernists like Derrida, Foucault. In fact, Habermas has even interacted with Joseph Ratzinger, who was Pope Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus. They're both Germans. They've had interaction back and forth. Now, I want you to appreciate that Habermas kind of started out life kind of embracing Marxism, you know, a very adamant atheist. Then he kind of went through a period where he just wasn't interested in the question of religion and kind of dived into, you know, these questions of pragmatism. But as he got older, he kind of came back to religion. And I want to I want to read a quote for you. Again, this is Jürgen Habermas, a German philosopher. Let's see, he comes in our list at number three. So he's high on the list. Here's what he said. He says, for the normative self-understanding of modernity, that's the modern world, Christianity has functioned as more than just a precursor or catalyst. Universalistic egalitarianism, from which sprang the ideas of freedom and collective life in solidarity, the autonomous conduct of life and emancipation, the individual morality of conscience, human rights and democracy, is the direct legacy of the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. This legacy, substantially unchanged, has been the object of a continual critical reappropriation and reinterpretation. Joe, here is a number three on the list, one of the most influential philosophers of the 20th century. I probably would put him in the category of an agnostic. You know, he, you know, some of philosophers are people and they have moods and they go through periods and they change their ideas. I think it's probably fair to say he's at least an agnostic, if not an atheist. And what has he said? He says, look at the world in which we live in, where men and women have freedom, where you can have a life of choice. There are ethics of justice and the ideas of love. He said, the Western world in which we live is indebted to the Bible and to the Judeo-Christian religions. I think Jürgen Habermas might be in that first category, where he says, you know, I don't know if God exists, maybe he doesn't. But if you look at Christianity and you look at the Bible, it has given us many of these things, the sense of having a moral conscience. So if God doesn't exist, where are you going to ground all this? Where do we get our morality? I've said many times, and I think it's true, I think atheism has a real hard time with three things in particular. Reason. Can you trust your reason if your brain evolved from the non-rational? I think they also have a problem with morality. Where does it come from? How do we ground it? And then I think the meaning of life. You know, there was a time when philosophers said, why not commit suicide? Would that be wrong if you don't know there's ultimate meaning? Well, here's Jürgen Habermas saying, whether you like it or not, whether you believe in God or not, and maybe he doesn't, he says Christianity has been a good thing. There is a growing number of people in that category, I think.
Yeah, thank you. I probably should have asked this earlier, and maybe you mentioned it and I forgot, but this list of 50, are we talking about people that are more or less contemporary? Maybe they've passed away recently, but they're pretty much contemporary, because somebody might say, what about somebody from 100 years ago? Aren't they continuing to cast a long shadow? But that, you're not incorporating philosophers from earlier times. Obviously, you know, Socrates, Aristotle, yeah. We're not including everybody. Otherwise, we'd be here for 20 podcasts.
Yes. No, that's a very good clarifying question. These are contemporary philosophers. I think of the 50, most of them are still alive. There are a few that have passed away, but they've passed away within the last decade or so. So we're not counting Aristotle and Plato. We're not counting St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, not counting Hume and Kant, all of those very influential philosophers. It's today's writings, and what you will see when we go through the list, I think, and again, I'm going to comment largely on the top 10, you'll see that postmodernism has had a big, postmodern philosophers have had a big influence. You'll see that some of the leading atheists have had a big influence, as well as Christians. But yeah, there's a couple people that have passed the scene over the last decade or so. but most of them are alive. Most of them are older. I think most are in their 70s, 80s, some in their 90s. So you are going to see, I think, and are already seeing that there is a turnover. Now, some of these older philosophers, as I mentioned before, they may be atheists, but they may not like the version of atheism that they see, you know, in the popular media.
Okay, thank you for that.
Well, let me now then contrast another individual on our list, and you've heard me talk about him before. This is Thomas Nagel. He's a living philosopher. He is a professor of mind at New York University. He is now emeritus. He's a big name in philosophy. Nagel is friends with some of the leading Christian philosophers. You know, it's a pretty small area, and these philosophers know each other. Nagel is close friends with Alvin Plantinga, with Waldersdorf, a number of leading Christian philosophers. Years ago, Joe, more than a decade ago, Nagel wrote a book entitled Mind and Cosmos. I wrote a review of that that you can get on the RTB website. But let me now give you Nagel. We've looked at Habermas as kind of the atheist who says, well, I don't know if God exists, maybe he doesn't, but we have to admit Christianity has been good for the world. Here's Tom Nagel, and he writes this as an atheist. He says, I lack the sensus divinitatis that enables, indeed compels, so many people to see in the world the expression of divine purpose as naturally as they see in a smiling face the expression of human feeling. He says in the last word, he wrote, I want atheism to be true. I am made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Well, here's Thomas Nagel, and he knows a lot about Christianity. I mean, he knows what the sensus divinitatis is. He knows that this is an idea that Calvin developed looking at Romans 1. Nick Waldersdorf, Alvin Plantinga have taken that idea and have said, you know, it appears that God has made himself known to us. And he's put it at the core of our being so that people are without excuse. Well, Nagel says, look, I don't seem to have the sensus divinitatis that Alvin Plantinga, you know, John Calvin, Thomas Aquinas talk about. I don't have that. But notice with Nagel, and again, I thought this was very interesting. He says, I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. I think clearly he's talking about Plantinga and very sharp, you know, theistic philosophers. But at the end of the day, it's not that there aren't reasons. It's not that there isn't some basis. He says, I don't want it to be that way. So his problem is, you know, maybe he doesn't think that God would be a good thing. Obviously, he doesn't. So I think in my book, Christianity Cross-Examined, I think that there is a growing element, and we talked about this in a previous show. We talked about Tom Holland. We talked about Jordan Peterson. These are people that seem to be secular in their orientation, but there is a growing kind of appreciation for the Christian worldview. And of course, this has led people to raise the question. Tim Keller says, you have to want to believe before you can believe. Now again, don't get me wrong in all of this, Joe. I believe ultimately people come to believe in God because of grace.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's the grace of God that ultimately allows a person, convicts them of their sin,
and gives them the recognition that they're accountable before the Lord. And it's grace that gives people faith and they're able to embrace Christianity. So don't get me wrong, but what I am saying is maybe God's grace is working in ways that we're not always aware of. It is possible that there are atheists are growing in awareness of the positive influence of Christianity, and maybe some of them kind of wish it were true. And if you wish it's true, that might already be a sign that God's already at work in your life.
Yeah, it's good news.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, so that's Thomas Nagel, and what number did he come in at?
Yeah, I think he is a little bit lower on the list, and I think the reason is, well, he's number 23.
This is a list of 50, right?
List of 50.
Yeah.
He's 23, and partly he probably dropped in terms of him being retired now. But again, I want to make that point that this numbering fluctuates.
Yeah. So if you it's academic influence. I don't know if you want to repeat. Right. The organization, if you type that in, you'll get to the site, academicinfluence.com.
Yeah, and I think, Joe, that when we look at these types of issues, I mean, academic philosophers, you know, they're interested in many things. And I think one of the real advantages of philosophy is that it does point you in particular direction. I mean, my interest in philosophy is definitely the philosophy of religion. That's different from the philosophy of science. My friend, for example, Mark Perez, who has been on various RTB programs and works with us reviewing books and has been a visiting scholar, he's a philosopher of science. And so he's going to apply his philosophical facilities to the study of science. Mine's more in religion, though I try to learn as much as I can about philosophy of science. But Joe, the areas of philosophy of religion would then raise the question of God's existence and the arguments for God's existence. It would look at the challenge of the problem of evil. It would look at human religious experiences. And, you know, so you would attempt to use your critical skills in philosophy to apply them to the phenomenon of religion. And I think that it is, a very, very valuable discipline. I think that, I think if you go into philosophy, you're going to be forced to think critically. Now, again, not every philosopher is, you know, thinking 24/7 about whether God exists. Some of them are, some of them are not. In fact, let me introduce to you one philosopher, and that's John Rawls. John Rawls has been a very influential philosopher in the 20th century, recently passed away. I wanted to tell you a little bit about him. He was a soldier in World War II. He fought in the Pacific. In fact, he was under the command of General MacArthur. And he was a Christian as a young man. And part of how he lost his faith, he became a very influential atheist. A lot of people, for example, try to argue that you can have objective morality without God. Well, Rawls is in that category. Rawls said, Joe, that seeing the effects of the atomic bomb and seeing the effects of the callousness of warfare, he said he lost his faith. The problem of evil, I mean, now, you know, think a little bit about this. Rawls said it was at Hiroshima. I've read later that the surface temperature at Nagasaki, this of course is the end of World War II, America dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. J-
Joe, I've read that the surface temperature at Nagasaki was 7,000 degrees. You know, if you've seen something like that, and John Rawls became a very influential philosopher, a very influential atheist, but he began as a Christian. So, you know, you have people who move around. You have people who are non-religious and become religious. You have people who are religious and they become non-religious. And you have a lot of different people. And again, in our next program, we'll look at the top 10 and talk a little bit about each one of them.
Terrific. All right. Anything more on that, Ken?
Well, let me recommend a couple books, if I might, Joe. There's two particular books. Now I've got to remember the title of them. One of them is entitled "Philosophers Who Believe." Philosophers Who Believe, and that gives you kind of the biography of some of these top-notch philosophers who are Christian. And there's another book that has a similar title to that that addresses a number of other philosophers. Maybe I'll pull that in when we do our...
You have too many philosophy books. That's the problem. You can't just grab one.
I have to say, Joe, that when I am in a bookstore or a library, I feel a sense of joy. And I probably have more books than I need, but not as many as I want.
And you're glad you have a credit card too, right?
I have a job so I can buy books and some food once in a while.
Okay. So we're going to talk some more about this in the next podcast, right?
You mentioned
the top 10, although I think one of these was in the...
Habermas is number
three. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. Thank you for your comments. I always appreciate them. And if you, the listener, if you have comments or questions, please send those in. We certainly appreciate hearing from you. You can reach Ken various ways. Many of you have contacted Ken on Facebook. His Twitter handle is @RTB_KSamples. You can also reach Ken at his blog, reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com. Where you can read the blog and then comment there. So thanks for your comments. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify. Look for the Reasons to Believe podcast, and you'll see Straight Thinking there. For Ken Samples, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.